Welcome to the Freeman on Tape, February 1990 edition. The Freeman on Tape is issued by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. The February 1990 edition of the Freeman on Tape contains, on side one, The Writings of Adam Smith by Julio H. Cole, and The Other Side of Adam Smith by William B. Irvine, and on side two, a fee classic, The Case for Economic Freedom by Benjamin A. Rogge. Reader's note: The Writings of Adam Smith and The Other Side of Adam Smith. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the death of Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations. This month's edition of the Freeman on Tape features two articles about this venerable economist and philosopher. The first is Professor Julio Cole's appreciation of Adam Smith's life and writings. The second, by Professor William Irvine, shows us yet another dimension of the economist, the other side of Adam Smith. The Writings of Adam Smith by Julio H. Cole. Reader's note: Professor Cole teaches in the economics department at the Universidad Francisco Marroquín in Guatemala. 2 centuries after his death in 1790, Adam Smith is still justly regarded as the single most towering figure in the history of modern economics. His celebrated work on the Wealth of Nations captured the spirit of industrial capitalism and presented its theoretical rationale in a form which dominated the thinking of the most influential political economists of the 19th century, and which continues to inspire free market advocates to this day. However, though few people would question the importance of Adam Smith for the history of economics, it is also important to realize that he was not merely or even primarily an economist. The field had not yet developed into an independent discipline in his time, and he himself regarded his wealth as only a partial exposition of a much larger work on the general principles of law and government and of the different revolutions they have undergone in the different ages and periods of society, which he hoped to write but never completed in his lifetime. Moreover, even in The Wealth of Nations, it is evident that Smith's conception of economic science encompassed much more than today's core fields of price theory, production and distribution, money and banking, public finance, international trade, and economic growth, each of which is regarded today as a specialty in itself. These topics are, of course, discussed at length in Smith's book, but it also includes detailed excursions into fields as diverse as ecclesiastical history, demographics, educational policy, military science, agriculture, and colonial affairs. Indeed, the sheer catholicity of his interests, embracing not only economics, ethics, political philosophy, and jurisprudence, but also literature, ancient and modern, linguistics, psychology, and the history of science, must seem staggering to the modern specialist. But no less staggering is the analytical depth which he applied in all his studies. Adam Smith was born in 1723 in Kirkcaldy, Scotland, the posthumous son by a second marriage of Adam Smith, Controller of Customs, and Margaret Douglas. The exact date of his birth is unknown, but he was baptized on June 5, 1723. And this date is often mistakenly taken as his birth date. Little is known about his childhood, except that at the age of 4, he was kidnapped by a band of gypsies, though prompt action by his uncle soon effected his rescue. "He would have made, I fear, a poor gypsy," commented John Ray, his main biographer. Apart from this incident, Smith's life was singularly quiet and uneventful, and his story is essentially that of his studies and his books. In 1737, at the age of 14, Having finished his term at the Kirkcaldy Grammar School, Smith entered the University of Glasgow, whereupon he came under the strong influence of the never-to-be-forgotten Francis Hutcheson, the famous professor of moral philosophy. Upon his graduation in 1740, Smith won an important scholarship, the Snell Exhibition, to Oxford, studying for 6 years in Balliol College. However, the intellectual atmosphere at Oxford at the time was lax and disappointing. The greater part of the public professors at Oxford have given up altogether even the pretense of teaching. And it will be his own fault if anyone should endanger his health at Oxford by excessive study. These years were devoted largely to a program of self-education, in which he read widely in both classical and modern literature and philosophy. Returning to his mother's home in 1746, Smith cast about for suitable employment, and meanwhile continued his studies. In 1748, he went to Edinburgh, where, under the sponsorship of Lord Henry Kames, he gave for 3 years a series of public lectures on rhetoric and belles lettres. In 1751, on the basis of this performance, he was called to his own University of Glasgow, first as professor of logic, and shortly after as professor of moral philosophy. The latter position he held for 12 years, a time which he later described as by far the most useful, and therefore by far the happiest and most honorable period of my life. His course was divided into four parts: natural theology, ethics, jurisprudence, and political economy. In 1759, he published his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which embodied the second portion of his course, and which almost immediately established his scholarly reputation. In 1761, he published an essay on The First Formation of Languages, which was included as an appendix in later editions of the Moral Sentiments. Six editions were published during Smith's lifetime. In 1763, Charles Townsend offered Smith a lifetime pension in return for acting as tutor to his stepson, the Duke of Buccleuch, on a 3-year tour of France. Smith thus gave up his professorship and embarked on his only trip abroad, in the course of which he met Voltaire in Geneva and associated with Turgot, Quesnay, and other French encyclopedists during his stay in Paris. In 1766, the sudden illness and death of Hugh Scott, the Duke's younger brother, also in Smith's charge, cut short the continental sojourn and forced a hasty return to England. For the next 7 years, Smith lived with his mother at Kirkcaldy and devoted most of his time to his Wealth of Nations. This period, too, he described as a happy one. As he said, "I was never perhaps more happy in all my life." In 1773, he traveled to London, taking his manuscript with him, and, apparently fearful for his health, named his friend David Hume as his literary executor, with instructions to publish, in the event of his death, his early essay on the history of astronomy, which was apparently part of an earlier grand project of A History of the Liberal Sciences and Elegant Arts. As it turned out, however, Hume died first in 1776. For the next 5 years, he lived in London, and his close friends included Edward Gibbon and Edmund Burke. In March 1776, The Wealth of Nations was published, and was an immediate and lasting success. The first edition was exhausted in 6 months, and in Smith's lifetime the book went through 5 editions. Also, within 3 decades, it had been translated into at least 6 foreign languages, Danish, 3 French versions, German, Italian, Spanish, and Russian. The only other work published by Smith in his lifetime, apart from 2 articles on literary subjects written for the Edinburgh Review in 1755, was his Letter to William Strawn, on the death of David Hume. His unqualified praise of his dear friend's moral qualities raised a storm of protest throughout Britain. As Smith was later to note, "A single and very harmless sheet of paper brought upon me 10 times more abuse than the very violent attack I had made upon the whole commercial system of Great Britain." In 1778, Smith was appointed Commissioner of Customs for Scotland and held that post until his death, dwelling with his mother and his cousin, Miss Janet Douglas, in Edinburgh. In 1787, Smith was elected Lord Rector of Glasgow University and served until 1789. On July 17, 1790, full of honors and recognition, Smith died at the age of 67. Prior to his death, Smith had ordered the destruction of most of his unpublished manuscripts, among which were probably his lectures on natural religion and jurisprudence, and his early lectures on rhetoric. Most of this material was thus probably lost forever, though part of it has since been recovered indirectly in the form of students' notes taken in the early 1760s. In 1795, Smith's literary executors, Joseph Black and James Hutton, edited and published a collection of essays on philosophical subjects, which included the aforementioned essay on the history of astronomy. The most well-known modern edition of these essays is The Early Writings of Adam Smith, edited by J.R. Lindgren. The story of Smith's writings does not end here, however. In 1895, Professor Edwin Cannon was alerted to the existence in the hands of an Edinburgh lawyer of a manuscript which he identified as the lecture notes taken by a student of a course on jurisprudence delivered by Smith sometime before his French voyage. Later scholars have established that the lectures were delivered in the portion of the 1763 to 1764 session which preceded Smith's departure. Cannon edited these notes and published them as Lectures on Justice, Police, Revenue, and Arms, delivered in the University of Glasgow by Adam Smith. In 1929, the Clements Library of the University of Michigan acquired a collection of papers which had belonged to Alexander Wedderburn, among which was an item which Professor G.H. Guttridge identified as a memorandum on the American problem, written by Smith in 1778. This material was edited by Guttridge and published in the American Historical Review. Finally, two additional sets of student notes were discovered by Professor John M. Lothian in 1958. One of these related to Smith's course of lectures on rhetoric and belles lettres as delivered at Glasgow in the 1762 to 1763 session. These notes were edited by Lothian and published as Lectures on Rhetoric and Belles Lettres. The second set of notes, relating to Smith's course on jurisprudence, as delivered in the same session, was not published until 1978 as part of the Glasgow edition of the works of Adam Smith. In our age of over-specialization, no one can help but be impressed by the range and depth of Smith's scholarship, a truly great embodiment of the spirit of the Scottish Enlightenment. However, much as we must admire his many accomplishments in so many fields, there is no denying that posterity has chosen to remember him mainly for his contributions to economics, and his fame will always rest foremost on his masterpiece, The Wealth of Nations. Though written in English in the 18th century, it now belongs to the world and to all times. Smith took economics forever beyond the narrow mercantilistic framework which denied the gains from trade between nations and made of it a study of the spontaneous and largely unintended social order which arises from free exchanges between individuals, exchanges which produce benefits for all parties involved, whether domestic or foreign. For as long as the love of liberty survives in this world, free men will continue to derive inspiration from Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations. Editor's note. Professor Cole has prepared a layman's guide to the scholarly literature surrounding the work of Adam Smith. If you would like a copy, please contact the Foundation for Economic Education. The Other Side of Adam Smith by William B. Irvine. Reader's Note. Professor Irvine teaches philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. Adam Smith has suffered the fate that often befalls the creator of a new ism. We no longer regard him as a mere mortal, but instead take him to be the embodiment of the doctrine he espoused. Many would like to think of Adam Smith as a one-dimensional, all-purpose capitalist. If the truth be known, though, Smith had another side that some will find shockingly anti-capitalistic. Nowhere does this other side come through more clearly than in Smith's theory of moral sentiments. See especially Chapter 1 of Part 4. In this work, published 17 years before his better-known Wealth of Nations, Smith is more interested in philosophy than in economics, and in it he questions what many would take to be basic tenets of capitalism. Smith, to begin with, questions whether material wealth, which capitalism produces so efficiently, is worth possessing. Power and riches appear to be what they are, enormous and operose machines, contrived to produce a few trifling conveniences to the body. The machines in question consist of springs, the most nice and delicate, which must be kept in order with the most anxious attention, and which, in spite of all our care, are ready every moment to burst into pieces and to crush in their ruins their unfortunate possessor. He reminds us that poverty, i.e., the absence of power and riches, has its advantages. The beggar who suns himself by the side of the highway possesses that security which kings are fighting for. Capitalism, as Smith well knows, is prodigious when it comes to supplying consumers with an endless stream of gadgets. Smith suspects, though, that little good can come of them. How many people ruin themselves by laying out money on trinkets of frivolous utility? All their pockets, he tells us, are stuffed with little conveniences. They walk about loaded with a multitude of baubles, some of which may sometimes be of some little use, but all of which might at all times be very well spared, and of which the whole utility is certainly not worth the fatigue of bearing the burden. By way of illustration, Smith tells us that a watch that falls behind above 2 minutes in a day is despised by one curious in watches. He sells it, perhaps, for a couple of guineas, and purchases another at 50, which will not lose above a minute a fortnight. There is a bit of a paradox in this, though, since after obtaining the new watch, the person in question will not always be found either more scrupulously punctual than other men, or more anxiously concerned upon any other account to know precisely what time of day it is. What has happened, of course, is that the owner of the watch has become more concerned with the watch itself than with his reason for buying a watch in the first place. Anyone who has ever traded up to a better stereo, car, or food processor knows the feeling. Smith then describes for us the life of the poor man's son, whom heaven in its anger has visited with ambition. This son admires the condition of the rich, and soon finds himself longing for a palace, a carriage, and servants, and to obtain them, he labors night and day to acquire talents superior to all his competitors. Indeed, to obtain the conveniences of being rich, he submits in the first year, nay, in the first month of his application, to more fatigue of body and more uneasiness of mind than he could have suffered through the whole of his life from the want of them. Consider along these lines the fate of the first-year law student, or of the entrepreneur who puts in 80-hour weeks in his attempt to start a new business. Smith concludes his tale of the poor man's son as follows. Through the whole of his life, he pursues the idea of a certain artificial and elegant repose, which he may never arrive at, for which he sacrifices a real tranquility that is at all times in his power, and which, if in the extremity of old age he should at last attain to it, he will find to be in no respect preferable to that humble security and contentment which he had abandoned for it. Smith would presumably not find it surprising that many Americans are willing to spend 50 weeks engaged in what is often unpleasant employment so that they can spend 2 weeks of artificial and elegant repose at some beach or mountain resort. According to Smith, the retirement of the ambitious man is not one to be admired. It is then, in the last dregs of life, his body wasted with toil and diseases, his mind galled and ruffled by the memory of 1,000 injuries and disappointments which he imagines he has met with from the injustice of his enemies, or from the perfidy and ingratitude of his friends, that he begins at last to find that wealth and greatness are mere trinkets of frivolous utility. I cannot read the above passages without thinking of Henry David Thoreau, whom many would take to be the polar opposite, philosophically speaking, of Adam Smith. A century after Smith, Thoreau told us that the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation, and asked, "Why should we be in such a desperate haste to succeed, and in such desperate enterprises?" Like Smith, Thoreau doubts that wealth can bring happiness, and thinks that men's labors tend to be in vain. The 12 labors of Hercules, he tells us, were trifling in comparison with those which my neighbors have undertaken, for they were only 12, and had an end. He continues in the same vein, "How many a poor immortal soul have I met well-nigh crushed and smothered under its load, creeping down the road of life, pushing before it a barn 75 feet by 40, its Augean stables never cleansed, and 100 acres of land, tillage, mowing, pasture, and woodlot." This is but one passage from Walden that would have blended perfectly into the text of the theory of moral sentiments. What are we to make of all this? Some might be tempted to deny that Adam Smith wrote the words I have attributed to him. Others might suggest that perhaps there were in fact two Adam Smiths, one a capitalist who wrote The Wealth of Nations, and the other a proto-Marxist who wrote the theory of moral sentiments. Yet others might pass off the theory of moral sentiments as a youthful indiscretion on the part of Smith, and hold him to have later outgrown the views he expressed there. I would like to suggest, though, that the writings of Smith in The Wealth of Nations and the theory of moral sentiments are not as inconsistent as they might appear to be. Indeed, I would like to suggest that those who claim that they are inconsistent are confused about the essential nature of capitalism. Notice, in the first place, that economics, insofar as it pretends to be a science, should be value neutral. It is not the economist's job to tell us what we should want or what we should do. Rather, it is his job, once we have told him what we want, to tell us how best to get it. Thus, it is not his job to tell us that we should reduce the unemployment rate. Instead, it is his job to tell us how best to do this, once we have decided it is worth accomplishing. Likewise, it is not the economist's job to tell us that we should take steps to guarantee every worker a minimum wage. Instead, it is his job to point out to us the undesirable consequences, i.e., undesirable according to our values, of our taking such steps. To be sure, most economists occasionally make pronouncements on what we should do. We should realize, though, that when they engage in this sort of behavior, they have temporarily set aside the mantle of the scientist and put on the mantle of, say, the philosopher. We should listen to what they have to say, but we should be skeptical about the claims they make. Let me add that we should likewise be skeptical whenever a philosopher presents us with economic forecasts. Seen in this light, there is nothing inconsistent about Adam Smith in his role as economist, telling us that capitalism can provide us with a remarkable array of kitchen gadgets, and Adam Smith, in his role as philosopher, telling us that kitchen gadgets aren't really worth manufacturing or owning. Notice in the second place that, contrary to popular belief, one can consistently be both anti-materialistic and a capitalist. For capitalism, besides possessing a remarkable ability to satisfy our desire for material things, is capable of satisfying our desire for non-material things. In a capitalist system, the resources of society are drawn by an invisible hand to produce efficiently whatever it is that the members of that society want, or more precisely, whatever it is that they are willing to pay for. If Americans were suddenly to lose interest in acquiring kitchen gadgets and instead found themselves driven to learn advanced topology, our capitalist system would likely respond by taking steps to put advanced topology into the hands, or rather the minds, of the masses. Similarly, if enough Americans decided to take after Thoreau and abandon their spacious homes in favor of huts in the woods, they would find the capitalist system amenable to their ends. Of course, capitalism in a society with Thoreauvian values would be quite unlike the capitalism we know in our society. It is unlikely that the resources of that society would be devoted to building automobile factories or banks. But then again, in a society with Thoreauvian values, few would regard this, or the disappearance of jobs that it would entail, as a loss. Those who are shocked by Smith's anti-materialistic utterances in The Theory of Moral Sentiments are, for the most part, those who incorrectly equate capitalism with materialism. Not only can one be an anti-materialistic capitalist, but it is quite possible that Adam Smith was one. Furthermore, just as one should not make the mistake of equating capitalism with materialism, one should not make the mistake of equating socialism with anti-materialism. A socialist can consistently have as his goal providing BMWs to all people, and not just to the rich. Indeed, a case can be made that one of the reasons socialist societies are crumbling around the world is that these societies failed to deliver the material goods they promised in the past. Just as it is possible for a capitalist to ridicule Americans' obsession with acquiring cars, houses, and kitchen gadgets, it is possible for a socialist to find himself craving a new VCR. In summary, Adam Smith was not the dogmatic capitalist that some would like him to be, but was instead a reflective person, one who realized that there is more to life than material well-being. Capitalists everywhere would do well to take this lesson to heart and to keep in mind the other side of Adam Smith. End of side one. Please turn the cassette over. A Fee Classic, The Case for Economic Freedom, by Benjamin A. Rogge. Reader's Note. The late Dr. Benjamin Rogge was a member of the faculty of Wabash College in Crawfordsville, Indiana, from 1949 to 1980, serving variously as teacher of economics, academic dean, director of the Wabash Institute of Personal Development, and distinguished professor of political economy. He was in international demand as a speaker and the author of numerous articles. Ben Rogge became a trustee of the Foundation for Economic Education in 1958, was chairman of the board from 1960 through 1962, and often lectured at fee seminars. One of his favorite topics, The Case for Economic Freedom, appeared in the Freeman in 1963. It is an appropriate testament to his guiding ideals. My economic philosophy is here offered with full knowledge that it is not generally accepted as the right one. On the contrary, my brand of economics has now become brand X, the one that is never selected as the whitest by the housewife, the one that is said to be slow acting, the one that contains no miracle ingredient. It loses 9 times out of 10 in the popularity polls run on election day, and in most elections, it doesn't even present a candidate. I shall identify my brand of economics as that of economic freedom. And I shall define economic freedom as that set of economic arrangements that would exist in a society in which the government's only function would be to prevent one man from using force or fraud against another, including within this, of course, the task of national defense. So that there can be no misunderstanding here, let me say that this is pure, uncompromising, laissez-faire economics. It is not the mixed economy. It is the unmixed economy. I readily admit that I do not expect to see such an economy in my lifetime, or in anyone's lifetime, in the infinity of years ahead of us. I present it rather as the ideal we should strive for, and should be disappointed in never fully attaining. Where do we find the most powerful and persuasive case for economic freedom? I don't know. Probably it hasn't been prepared as yet. Certainly, it is unlikely that the case I present is the definitive one. However, it is the one that is persuasive with me, that leads me to my own deep commitment to the free market. I present it as grist for your own mill, and not as the divinely inspired last word on the subject. You will note as I develop my case that I attach relatively little importance to the demonstrated efficiency of the free market system in promoting economic growth, in raising levels of living. In fact, my central thesis is that the most important part of the case for economic freedom is not its vaunted efficiency as a system for organizing resources, not its dramatic success in promoting economic growth, but rather its consistency with certain fundamental moral principles of life itself. I say the most important part of the case for two reasons. First, the significance I attach to these moral principles would lead me to prefer the free enterprise system, even if it were demonstrably less efficient than alternative systems, even if it were to produce a slower rate of economic growth than systems of central direction and control. Second, the great mass of the people of any country is never really going to understand the purely economic workings of any economic system, be it free enterprise or socialism. Hence, most people are going to judge an economic system by its consistency with their moral principles, rather than by its purely scientific operating characteristics. If economic freedom survives in the years ahead, it will be only because a majority of the people accept its basic morality. The success of the system in bringing ever higher levels of living will be no more persuasive in the future than it has been in the past. Let me illustrate. The doctrine of man, held in general in 19th century America, argued that each man was ultimately responsible for what happened to him, for his own salvation, both in the here and now and in the hereafter. Thus, whether a man prospered or failed in economic life was each man's individual responsibility. Each man had a right to the rewards for success and, in the same sense, deserved the punishment that came with failure. It followed as well that it is explicitly immoral to use the power of government to take from one man to give to another, to legalize Robin Hood. This doctrine of man found its economic counterpart in the system of free enterprise, and hence the system of free enterprise was accepted and respected by many who had no real understanding of its subtleties as a technique for organizing resource use. As this doctrine of man was replaced by one which made of man a helpless victim of his subconscious and his environment, responsible for neither his successes nor his failures, the free enterprise system came to be rejected by many who still had no real understanding of its actual operating characteristics. Inasmuch as my own value systems and my own assumptions about human beings are so important to the case, I want to sketch them for you. To begin with, the central value in my choice system is individual freedom. By freedom, I mean exactly and only freedom from coercion by others. I do not mean the four freedoms of President Roosevelt, which are not freedoms at all, but only rhetorical devices to persuade people to give up some of their true freedom. In the Rogge system, each man must be free to do what is his duty as he defines it, so long as he does not use force against another. Next, I believe each man to be ultimately responsible for what happens to him. True, he is influenced by his heredity, his environment, his subconscious, and by pure chance. But I insist that precisely what makes man man is his ability to rise above these influences, to change and determine his own destiny. If this be true, then it follows that each of us is terribly and inevitably and forever responsible for everything he does. The answer to the question, who's to blame, is always, mea culpa, I am. I believe as well that man is imperfect, now and forever. He is imperfect in his knowledge of the ultimate purpose of his life, imperfect in his choice of means to serve those purposes he does select, imperfect in the integrity with which he deals with himself and those around him, imperfect in his capacity to love his fellow man. If man is imperfect, then all of his constructs must be imperfect, and the choice is always among degrees and kinds of imperfection. The New Jerusalem is never going to be realized here on earth, and the man who insists that it is always lost unto freedom. Moreover, man's imperfections are intensified as he acquires the power to coerce others. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. This completes the listing of my assumptions, and it should be clear that the list does not constitute a total philosophy of life. Most importantly, it does not define what I believe the free man's duty to be, or, more specifically, what I believe my own duty to be, and the source of the charge to me. However important these questions, I do not consider them relevant to the choice of an economic system. Here, then, are two sections of the case for economic freedom as I would construct it. The first section presents economic freedom as an ultimate end in itself, and the second presents it as a means to the preservation of the non-economic elements in total freedom. The first section of the case is made in the stating of it, if one accepts the fundamental premise. Major premise: each man should be free to take whatever action he wishes, so long as he does not use force or fraud against another. Minor premise: All economic behavior is action, as identified above. Conclusion. Each man should be free to take whatever action he wishes in his economic behavior, so long as he does not use force or fraud against another. In other words, economic freedom is part of total freedom. If freedom is an end in itself, as our society has traditionally asserted it to be, then economic freedom is an end in itself, to be valued for itself alone and not just for its instrumental value in serving other goals. If this thesis is accepted, then there must always exist a tremendous presumption against each and every proposal for governmental limitation of economic freedom. What is wrong with a state system of compulsory social security? It denies to the individual his freedom, his right to choose what he will do with his own money resources. What is wrong with a governmentally enforced minimum wage? It denies to the employer and the employee their individual freedoms, their individual rights to enter into voluntary relationships not involving force or fraud. What is wrong with a tariff or an import quota? It denies to the individual consumer his right to buy what he wishes, wherever he wishes. It is breathtaking to think what this simple approach would do to the apparatus of state control at all levels of government. Strike from the books all legislation that denies economic freedom to any individual, and 3/4 of all the activities now undertaken by government would be eliminated. I am no dreamer of empty dreams, and I do not expect that the day will ever come when this principle of economic freedom as a part of total freedom will be fully accepted and applied. Yet, I am convinced that unless this principle is given some standing, unless those who examine proposals for a new regulation of the individual by government look on this loss of freedom as a cost of the proposed legislation, the chances of free enterprise surviving are small indeed. The would-be controller can always find reasons why it might seem expedient to control the individual, unless slowed down by some general feeling that it is immoral to do so, he will usually have his way. So much for the first section of the case. Now for the second. The major premise here is the same, that is, the premise of the rightness of freedom. Here, though, the concern is with the non-economic elements in total freedom, with freedom of speech, of religion, of the press, of personal behavior. My thesis is that these freedoms are not likely to be long preserved in a society that has denied economic freedom to its individual members. Before developing this thesis, I wish to comment briefly on the importance of these non-economic freedoms. I do so because we who are known as conservatives have often given too little attention to these freedoms, or have even played a significant role in reducing them. The modern liberal is usually inconsistent in that he defends man's non-economic freedoms, but is often quite indifferent to his economic freedom. The modern conservative is often inconsistent in that he defends man's economic freedom, but is indifferent to his non-economic freedoms. Why are there so few conservatives in the struggles over censorship, over denials of equality before the law for people of all races, over blue laws, and so on? Why do we let the modern liberals dominate an organization such as the American Civil Liberties Union? The general purposes of this organization are completely consistent with, even necessary to, the truly free society. particularly in times of stress such as these. We must fight against the general pressure to curb the rights of individual human beings, even those whose ideas and actions we detest. Now is the time to remember the example of men such as David Ricardo, the London banker and economist of the classical free market school in the first part of the last century. Born a Jew, married to a Quaker, he devoted some part of his energy and his fortune to eliminating the legal discrimination against Catholics in the England of his day. It is precisely because I believe these non-economic freedoms to be so important that I believe economic freedom to be so important. The argument here could be drawn from the wisdom of the Bible and the statement that where a man's treasure is, there will his heart be also. Give me control over a man's economic actions and hence over his means of survival, and except for a few occasional heroes, I'll promise to deliver to you men who think and write and behave as I want them to. The case is not difficult to make for the fully controlled economy, the true socialistic state. Milton Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, in his book Capitalism and Freedom, takes the case of a socialist society that has a sincere desire to preserve the freedom of the press. The first problem would be that there would be no private capital, no private fortunes that could be used to subsidize an anti-socialist, pro-capitalist press. Hence, the socialist state would have to do it. However, the men and women undertaking the task would have to be released from the socialist labor pool and would have to be assured that they would never be discriminated against in employment opportunities in the socialist apparatus if they were to wish to change occupations later. Then these pro-capitalist members of the socialist society would have to go to other functionaries of the state to secure the buildings, the presses, the paper, the skilled and unskilled workmen, and all the other components of a working newspaper. Then they would face the problem of finding distribution outlets, either creating their own, a frightening task, or using the same ones used by the official socialist propaganda organs. Finally, where would they find readers? How many men and women would risk showing up at their state-controlled jobs carrying copies of the Daily Capitalist? There are so many unlikely steps in this process that the assumption that true freedom of the press could be maintained in a socialist society is so unrealistic as to be ludicrous. Of course, we are not facing as yet a fully socialized America, but only one in which there is significant government intervention in a still predominantly private enterprise economy. Do these interventions pose any threat to the non-economic freedoms? I believe they do. First of all, the total of coercive devices now available to any administration of either party at the national level is so great that true freedom to work actively against the current administration, whatever it might be, is seriously reduced. For example, farmers have become captives of the government in such a way that they are forced into political alignments that seriously reduce their ability to protest actions they do not approve. Second, the form of these interventions is such as to threaten seriously one of the real cornerstones of all freedoms, equality before the law. For example, farmers and trade union members are now encouraged and assisted in doing precisely that for which businessmen are sent to jail, i.e., acting collusively to manipulate prices. The blindfolded goddess of justice has been encouraged to peek, and she now says, with the jurists of the ancient regime, "First, tell me who you are, and then I'll tell you what your rights are." A society in which such gross inequalities before the law are encouraged in economic life is not likely to be one which preserves the principle of equality before the law generally. We could go on to many specific illustrations. For example, the government uses its legislated monopoly to carry the mails as a means for imposing a censorship on what people send to each other in a completely voluntary relationship. A man and a woman who exchange obscene letters may not be making productive use of their time, but their correspondence is certainly no business of the government. Or, to take an example from another country, Winston Churchill, as a critic of the Chamberlain government, was not permitted 1 minute of radio time on the government-owned and monopolized broadcasting system in the period from 1936 to the outbreak of the war he was predicting in 1939. Every act of intervention in the economic life of its citizens gives to a government additional power to shape and control the attitudes, the writings, the behavior of those citizens. Every such act is another break in the dike protecting the integrity of the individual as a free man or woman. The free market protects the integrity of the individual by providing him with a host of decentralized alternatives rather than with one centralized opportunity. As Friedman has reminded us, even the known communist can readily find employment in capitalist America. The free market is politics blind, religion blind, and yes, race blind. Do you ask about the politics or the religion of the farmer who grew the potatoes you buy at the store? Do you ask about the color of the hands that helped produce the steel you use in your office building? South Africa provides an interesting example of this. The South Africans, of course, provide a shocking picture of racial bigotry, shocking even to a country that has its own tragic race problems. South African law clearly separates the whites from the non-whites. Orientals have traditionally been classed as non-whites, but South African trade with Japan has become so important in the post-war period that the government of South Africa has declared the Japanese visitors to South Africa to be officially and legally white. The free market is one of the really great forces making for tolerance and understanding among human beings. The controlled market gives man rein to express all those blind prejudices and intolerant beliefs to which he is forever subject. To look at this another way, the free market is often said to be impersonal, and indeed it is. Rather than a vice, this is one of its great virtues. Because the relations are substantially impersonal, they are not usually marked by bitter personal conflict. It is precisely because the labor union attempts to take the employment relationship out of the marketplace that bitter personal conflict so often marks union management relationships. The intensely personal relationship is one that is civilized only by love, as between man and wife, and within the family. But man's capacity for love is severely limited by his imperfect nature. Far better, then, to economize on love, to reserve our dependence on it to those relationships where even our imperfect natures are capable of sustained action based on love. Far better, then, to build our economic system on largely impersonal relationships and on man's self-interest, a motive power with which he is generously supplied. One need only study the history of such utopian experiments as our Indiana's Harmony and New Harmony to realize that a social structure which ignores man's essential nature results in the dissension, conflict, disintegration, and dissolution of Robert Owen's New Harmony, or the absolutism of Father Rapp's Harmony. The vulgar calculus of the marketplace, as its critics have described it, is still the most humane way man has yet found for solving those questions of economic allocation and division which are ubiquitous in human society. By what must seem fortunate coincidence, it is also the system most likely to produce the affluent society, to move mankind above an existence in which life is mean, nasty, brutish, and short. But of course, this is not just coincidence. Under economic freedom, only man's destructive instincts are curbed by law. All of his creative instincts are released and freed to work those wonders of which free men are capable. In the controlled society, only the creativity of the few at the top can be utilized, and much of this creativity must be expended in maintaining control and in fending off rivals. In the free society, the creativity of every man can be expressed. And surely by now we know that we cannot predict who will prove to be the most creative. You may be puzzled, then, that I do not rest my case for economic freedom on its productive achievements, on its buildings, its houses, its automobiles, its bathtubs, its wonder drugs, its television sets, its sirloin steaks and green salads with Roquefort dressings. I neither feel within myself, nor do I hear in the testimony of others, any evidence that man's search for purpose, his longing for fulfillment, is in any significant way relieved by these accomplishments. I do not scorn these accomplishments, nor do I worship them. Nor do I find in the lives of those who do worship them any evidence that they find ultimate peace and justification in their idols. I rest my case, rather, on the consistency of the free market with man's essential nature, on the basic morality of its system of rewards and punishments, on the protection it gives to the integrity of the individual. The free market cannot produce the perfect world, but it can create an environment in which each imperfect man may conduct his lifelong search for purpose in his own way, in which each day he may order his life according to his own imperfect vision of his destiny, suffering both the agonies of his errors and the sweet pleasure of his successes. This freedom is what it means to be a man. This is the Godhead, if you wish. I give you, then, the free market, the expression of man's economic freedom, and the guarantor of all his other freedoms.